Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center, and I'm at the Capitol with Senator Dan McKay.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here.
He's on the right, and on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. How you doing?
Yeah.
Hanging with us? Thank you.
So I don't know where to start, but we're going to go to our nation's capital, and let's do USAID first. So this is the Doge, the money-saving, you know, Elon Musk efforts, and has pretty much taken the rug out from under USAID.
Yeah.
Dan, I don't know how much you've had exposure to this quasi-government, Shireen, I'll go to you first, but I will say when I worked in Washington, I was taught that the United States of America is the most generous country on earth.
Yeah.
And I remember just kind of it sat with me.
Yeah. So USAID, I think some listeners know, but I served in the United States Peace Corps from 2003 to 2005. There's a lot of interplay between Peace Corps and USAID. And I want people to just come on a mental journey with me because I understand that kind of gut reaction, especially in this America First era, mm-hmm. right? Like, why yeah. are we spending?
We have needs, and yet we're paying for things that many don't agree with in other countries.
Or understand, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, some of the people that I worked with had done work with USAID on trying to increase capacity at fisheries in foreign countries to do work that was related to pandemic preparedness. Right now, we're seeing an outbreak of Ebola and hemorrhagic fever in places like Uganda and Sudan. In Sudan, there's an ethnic crisis. This is also, you know, we're seeing crises like in Gaza that continue. Folks who work for USAID are deeply tied to these kinds of negotiations and careful work that goes into investing in places. And I really need people to hear this so that ideally people can be safe where they live, that they can stay in communities, that they can reduce their exposure to things like HIV and AIDS, that they are not fleeing their country because they're being persecuted for their religious or their sexual orientation, whatever it may be. These programs invest in our global security to reduce people fleeing for refugee status or for health reasons to come to the United States. So these programs do create a broader sense of global security, but this is not a priority for Republicans at this time.
Yeah.
And understand that there are real consequences. That means we talk about increased risk around pandemic, increased risk around disease spread, people living in greater unsafe conditions globally.
And you have listened patiently. You just watched and listened to Shireen there. Give us your quick take.
Well, our goal, like, we got to be respectful, right? Yeah. And I love that.
And we got to be a generous country.
And we got to be a generous country. Mm-hmm. And I get all of those things where much is given, much is required, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody say mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. that's our idea. The problem is in organizations, you know, so in the last 4 years or the President Biden administration, it went from at the end of the Trump administration, USAID was receiving $20 billion, if I remember mm-hmm. right. And by the end of the Biden administration, it was $42 billion. There was a doubling during that 4 year mm-hmm. period. Mm-hmm. And everybody's like, OK, so what were the expenses? And when Trump got in and his people started looking through and started looking at the wires that were getting ready to go out to USAID and several other organizations, they started saying, wait a second, what are these for?
Time out.
And mm-hmm. and they started, and I will say, I can say this with some like accuracy, I think, but there is a sense in just about every company, there is a percentage of the company that exists because the company can support it. But when a company can't support it, that stuff gets really narrow, right? And you look at the fiscal condition of the United States and you say, well, should they be putting, you know, a few million dollars into condom promulgation? Should they be putting, you know, $500,000 into money to promote atheism in Nepal? Should they, you know, like go down some of the lists of the DEI initiatives? And there were money in that stuff. And if you just look at all of the things that were potentially being saved, even if part of them were true, it's like, man, there's got to be some other way to do this that doesn't include these things. And the president is following this track with like block grants to states, right? He's saying, well, maybe we don't need to have an NGO or an organization that's doing this. Maybe direct grants are the better way to go on a lot of things.
And I just have to go back to this kind of notion. I think it's really important that we stop just sort of lumping. I mean, at this point, DEI is responsible for everything from plane crashes to, I guess, the reason that we need to find money to give tax cuts billionaires. So DEI, when we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, when we're thinking about programs that are, for example, protecting folks, I don't know if you have been following, but like what is happening to queer people in places like Russia, where they're regularly killed, mm-hmm, right, for mm-hmm. their for being a queer person. when we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, that is what we are. I just think it's important to kind of break these things apart.
When we take our worldview, Shireen, about how we feel about one thing or another, and we try to push it on other people, there used to be Democrats used to be really against, you know, colonialization of America, right?
Wow.
And you look at where we are, is we seem to be expanding along that principle. And if you look at the money that USAID and others were sending out, it's clear we're trying to put our way of lifestyle into other cultures. I'm not sure that's the right way to go.
Well, we've done that, I mean, forever, on when we think about interventions that we've had on governments that we don't like, right? So
Last time I was on this show, I think we referenced the term shock and awe. This administration is engaged in shock and awe, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I think how you do things matters, and it's quite interesting to me to see Elon Musk now be a special government employee. I think it's also interesting that he's now got a spot, an office, you know, nearby the president. We could talk a lot about that, but I want to just ask this. How long do the two of you think it is before Elon Musk and Donald Trump have a falling apart?
Oh.
Let's see if we can predict something here.
I will say,
maybe you don't think it's going to happen.
I don't know if there's a timeline, but I will tell you, when the first politically hotbed issue that his base doesn't support that Elon touches, that's when it blows up on that relationship. I'm not sure what that third rail is yet, because nothing appears to be sacred to the president. But at the end of the day, that's when I think it blows up.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I think generally the American public is against an unelected billionaire dictating policy or movements to the president. And we're seeing a lot of that.
And George Soros did a lot of it. I agree. That was a very bad idea.
Having access to confidential data, getting rid of tax preparation programs.
I know that George Soros is a huge boogeyman for you, but like really Soros have access to the Treasury?
I don't have a problem. The thing I have is, it's the irony of hypocrisy that the left does not recognize, that America just has said, we're kind of dumb. Like, that's what I think everybody is missing, right? He is 3 weeks into a presidency now. And at the end of the day, he is clearly planning to change, upset, and move things. And he got there with the mandate he feels, and I agree with him. And so let's see what shakes out. Because what if, this is the only thing I'll ask you. Everybody says, well, you know, the deep state, this or that. You hear that on the right. Sometimes you hear it, you know, from the far left as well. And what I'd say is, like, there's a possibility that somewhere within our government, like, there are things that we would not all be approving of if it was all brought to light of day. Okay. And I think that the one thing about having a president like President Trump and Elon Musk at the end of the day, what I'd say is, you've got a lot of people who are very nervous and are going to be working hard to discredit all of them, to try and stop this stuff from coming out.
Yeah, Dan, the risk reward here is crazy in my mind. Yeah. I think we're taking massive risks, and I hope the reward matches it. So let's go to one other interesting one, Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
This week, President Trump, you know, basically laid the path for U.S. intervention in Gaza, potentially troops on the ground, potentially taking a role in, you know, developing it as
taking
a Riviera
of the
Middle East. That blindsided me. I thought he was against, involvement in foreign wars.
That's one place with the president I'm like, I don't know, man.
Gaza, of all places.
I know.
You know?
I know. Greenland, I get. But
Panama Canal, I get.
I get them.
There's some interest. But the risk to developing Gaza and thinking that it doesn't become a symbol that is constantly under terrorist threat.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and just like, let's back up a minute. If you can understand one thing that I believe about this presidency, is that it is a grift. What he wants to do, and there has been numerous commentary from his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who would like to develop this area of land, which is beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has been decimated now.
If you've not been to Tel Aviv, it's an unbelievable city.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So this
because
area
of its,
the world,
you know, it's the Mediterranean.
It's the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. This is a presidency deeply oriented around keeping Donald Trump out of jail, out of consequences for his actions, and to benefit him financially. And I would say the billionaires who have helped him get there.
Shireen, maybe I agree of some of that, but not all of it. But the one I would add, the characteristic I would add that I think is most fascinating about this president, is he's taking down the swamp, the deep state, the growth in government that so many Americans are opposed to. So, you know, sit with that how you want. But
yeah.
But it feels to me, when I first heard the president say drain the swamp, I was like, wow, that's powerful. Because federal bureaucracy, federal government, it's big and it does intrude on people's lives.
And if Congress doesn't like it, guess what? They can fix it, right? This comes back to what we talked about last week. It's like, okay, if it makes you uncomfortable, then Congress, get involved. Like, make this work. Instead of filing stupid articles of impeachment, you had one guy that's sitting there, you know, a Democrat from Georgia today, talks about how he's going to file articles of impeachment with Trump already.
Crazy.
Because of this. And it's like, yeah, that's crazy talk. This is the one thing, going back to our earlier part, it's like, I liked this about the Biden stuff, is because the Biden pardons, because Congress doesn't have the Biden administration to use as a straw man for the next 2 years to run on their election, right? Mm-hmm. So they got to actually focus on being productive. And the cruddy thing is that the left saw the results of the election, mm-hmm. and what their outcome is, let's file articles of impeachment within 3 weeks.
Okay, so I just need to go back to say, Democrats as a party and people in this country certainly are different. And I think the same about Republicans, right, as a party. And I do have to say, like, it is amazing to me that we just kind of continue to act like this is a legitimate party that's doing legitimate things. But let's move to this idea, back to drain the swamp. Sure, people don't like the idea that government, right? Mm-hmm. But you know what they do like? They like it when, for example, they're on Medicare and their healthcare bills get paid.
Sure.
They like it when they fly and they're safe and they safely land because air traffic control is working. They like it when their meat is not poisoned because we dealt with avian flu. They like it when government works. What we don't like is when we do see the dysfunction that we see out of Washington.
Yeah, and there's disconnect. The public doesn't understand government very well. I go back to the Tea Party days, when the famous quote of the guy at a public meeting said, "Keep your big government hands off my Medicare."
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Which, to our listeners, if you don't understand, it's completely government.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Hey, our listeners understand.
We got to take a break, but I'm determined to not speak about Trump every week, you know, the whole program, but the pace of change that he's moving at, it makes it hard.
Yeah.
But in our next segment, we're going to talk about the state legislative session. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm so grateful to be with my friends here. I learned so much on this program from both of you. I was telling Shireen, Dan, that I'm not keeping up on the news because I'm sort of emotionally withdrawn. Mm. It's hard for me. Mm. And then also I'm really busy.
Is it your... Because you have very much a respect for institutions, right? Like, that's always
huge.
A thing for you. And so seeing the institutional changes and the disruption,
and the
that you know that the people
and the productive
hurt?
Middle not getting enough time and attention. Yeah, yeah, because, you know, maybe I agree with some of the problems with USAID, but I'd go about it differently.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like on Capitol Hill, where I get involved, I'm always involved in trying to listen to both sides and find common ground to move forward. That's my sweet spot.
Yeah.
And I don't see a lot of that happening.
The problem.
I see it in Utah. I just don't see it nationally.
And the one thing I'll offer, this is like, I have this philosophical debate about this issue every once in a while. It you know, when you have big government and small government, right? And the compromise means the government still got bigger. It just got less big than the bigger side planned, right? Mm-hmm. And eventually when you got small government and bigger government and you got this constant creep of like size, I guess, or what, you know, influence or whatever, there's this push back. And I think that's what you're seeing in America, is we've compromised too much. We need to reset things a little bit and reprogram.
And many people argue, and I'm looking at you, Shireen, because I know you'll disagree, but it's an interesting point, that the only way you can get that kind of retreat or shrinkage of government is with someone with the characteristics and even talent of a Donald Trump.
Mm, yeah.
You know, because
you mean an authoritarian leader.
You lost her at talent. Lost her.
Well, I mean, you know, we don't want to do this. We're talking about, but the tariffs, you know, he pretty much used his
everything
big tariff from Mexico and Canada and got leverage out of the deal to get action from these two, you know, friends and neighbors.
It is the difference between, you know, we have, I mean, I will say that the executive branch has been somewhat on cruise control for a little while. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that even goes back into COVID. I just say, you know, we've been recovering, and I think everybody's back to where everybody was in 2016 of how do we reset this? How do we, you know?
Sure. But I just want to also add, though, that we did see tariffs go into place with China. Mm-hmm. And what that is a tax on the middle class and mm-hmm. working families, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to see increased costs at the gas pump. We're talking about implications for energy.
Fed did not lower rates again.
Did not lower rates inflation. Again. Yeah. So this ultimately comes back to everyday folks. Yeah, all right. So
state issues. We tried.
Come on, state issues.
We tried.
I got one.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You go ahead.
Okay. So I think I am deeply concerned to see our attorney general, who you told me would be a moderate, mm-hmm. a middle of the road kind of guy, signing on to basically end birthright citizenship. And, you know, we just had a day without immigrants this week. My understanding is that there are about just shy of 100,000, 95,000 immigrants mm-hmm. in Utah, mm-hmm. 12% of the population. We know that these folks are working hard in a number of jobs where we have a hard time mm-hmm. filling roles. So mm-hmm. we're talking construction, service industry work, right? Many other areas where we know it's hard to find workers. And to see this kind of action from our attorney general right out the gate is not heartening to me. And I also feel like it's out of step with values of many Utahns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dan, she's looking at me, but I don't know this issue very well. Yeah. I will just say that I think what the point here is to take away an incentive for people to come here illegally to have their children here and give them citizenship.
I think that's, you know, there used to be this terrible term that was, you know, that was floated around. I remember Mia Love, when I was on her working on her campaign back in the day, people kept calling her an anchor baby because her parents came mm-hmm. and, you know, had a kid, mm-hmm. had her. And as a result, they got citizenship later. Mm-hmm. Right. And mm-hmm. so there was that disincentive. I mean, the 14th Amendment is really where this all comes down, where it says mm-hmm. all persons born or naturalized in the United States, right, or citizens. It's a citizenship clause. And that really becomes the debate for, you know, the field of debate. And there are some, in fact, I read the briefs, at least I read Utah's version of it. And as I look at that brief, what I see is there are questions as to unsettled law and how do we settle it, right?
Okay.
Is it good? Is it bad?
So
I don't know.
Utah signs on to get those questions answered.
I think that's a fair way to look at it.
Generous interpretation.
Generous indeed. I think
take me to vote by mail, Dan. This is such a big issue on Capitol Hill right now.
I
almost said on campus. That shows you my affiliation.
I hear so much about how much people really like to vote by mail, you know, and mm-hmm. just really like the opportunity to vote by mail. I hear from even, you know, conservatives who under their breath are like, I know everybody else is saying it's a good idea, but I still feel like I want to vote by mail. So there's that part of it. Mm-hmm. House Bill 300 is the one that is being, you know, debated as dealing with this issue. And there's still a lot of debate about it. I think the bill currently requires we'll mail everybody a ballot, but in order to, you know, return it, you've got to verify your ID when you drop it off. And I think what that's going to end up requiring is a lot more drop-off locations than we currently have.
A lot more cost.
Which then becomes a lot more cost. That said, make it easy to participate and difficult to cheat is like the principle that everybody's trying to follow when mm-hmm. we're trying to do this. And there's got to be a way to solve both.
Yeah. Dan, what's interesting to me is for me and most of the people in my little world, this does not affect them too much because they're going to vote.
Yeah. And they have IDs.
What I worry about is it creates a higher barrier and voter participation drops. That's mm-hmm. really problematic to me.
Yeah. I mean, we're already missing a lot of voters, right? We have a pretty good voter turnout rate in this state. And I think in part it's because it is easy.
Do you remember what it is?
No.
And the last presidential
was
over 84, 85%.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's voting age population.
It's kind of abysmal in municipals, but it's really good.
Well, that's higher than I was thinking. I'm glad you could quote it, Dan, because, you know, that gives me some comfort.
I was going to say 70.
Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt you. Sure.
Okay, I'll just say that this to me feels like so out of step with what's happening. I feel like if Republicans were rapidly losing control in this state, and maybe if we had fair districts, you would be. But because we are not seeing that right now, I just have to ask, why are we making it more difficult for a supermajority to continue to get elected in this state? The stories that we have heard, very few examples of voter fraud have come forward. And frankly, and I mean this lovingly, but some of the examples that come up are folks who are voting on behalf of their missionaries who are abroad.
This is
voter fraud in our state. Mm-hmm. What is this trying to solve?
Well, I think what you have is you've got polling, information around the state where people are having increasingly less faith in the election outcomes, right? It's not necessarily that there is an actual problem, but it's the perception.
There is an actual problem, sure.
It's the perception, right?
So how do you
fix the perception and fix the process so that at the end of the day, you fix the perception too? And I don't see, if we go forward and say, hey, you've got to have your ID when you drop off your ballot, maybe we'll do that for a couple elections and then we'll say, we didn't get everything we needed out of that. Or maybe we need to do it differently. I just have faith in the process working out in time.
I would suggest that I think something that could happen is a real serious investment in civics education and trust building between lawmakers and communities.
We spend $8,000 per student in K-12 education on a lot of civic education, Shireen.
You know that our civic education is not that good. When people actually are asked how their government works, they have no idea.
I don't disagree with that, but it requires an intellectual curiosity that someone has to want to know about the government.
If we made the environment maybe more inviting for high quality teachers to stay around, we would have more engaged classrooms.
Hey, I'm starting to see these tweets of mail elections. Our thing are going to lead to mail elections, M-A-L-E.
Ah!
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Hey, let's go to this gerrymandering case. This is really interesting. Yes. This is meaningful.
Yeah.
Right? So this is a case that's basically saying that the legislature, when they drew the boundaries, didn't pay attention to the citizens initiative. It was heard in court last week. Mm-hmm. Who wants to go first here?
Well, so basically the initial ruling from the state Supreme Court, or I guess not initial, but the ruling from the state Supreme Court says that Utahns do have a right to change their government. Mm-hmm. And the legislature threw the maps that were created by the Independent Commission into the trash. Mm-hmm. And I'll say there were some Democrats who voted for that too. So it wasn't just Republicans, unfortunately. And what the lawsuit then suggests is that we should have fair districts in this that a majority of voters in Utah voted for fair maps, and we have the right to do that, to receive that. Now, this went to court on last week. What do you think is going to happen, Natalie?
Oh, I have a gut feeling that the courts are going to say the legislature's okay on this. But that's, Dan, the reason I'm thinking that is it's so clear that it's a legislative responsibility.
Yeah.
I just have this feeling. And it was so disruptive to change congressional districts, I'll say, between censuses.
Yeah, especially because we are looking at, if we redraw now, we're redrawing again because most likely we'll have a population that will warrant a fifth congressional seat potentially. And so, there's those dynamics. I don't know what to make of the hearing. It really is disappointing that, I felt like even though the Alternate Reform Clause did not exist at the time that the Citizen Initiative Clause existed, the Supreme Court mistakenly analyzed it as though it existed at the same time. Let's just let that to the side. And I will say, I understand the frustration and the concerns. Redistricting is the type of thing that is in the Utah Constitution left to the legislature. Mm-hmm. And they say it shouldn't be a political decision. I'm like, since when has real estate and map drawing and who serves in what place? Since when is that not political?
Yeah.
It is political through and through.
But I'm in the productive middle world, right? I would love to see them not break up cities. Yeah. Simple things like that.
That's fair.
I'd love to see them not to make it so you're in a different district than your local library.
Right, which made a lot more sense back in the day when there was gaps between cities and there were actually quote communities of interest. Mm-hmm. Now, it's wall to wall city on the Wasatch Front. Mm-hmm. You are not finding much space, mm-hmm. and so the idea of and our city boundaries are super weird too, mm-hmm. in a lot mm-hmm. of places. So mm-hmm. I get it, and it would be nice to do that. I guarantee when you've got 200 or almost 300 cities in the state of Utah, if a couple of them share a representative, that's not too bad.
Yeah, I'll just say that this is a very good argument for letting politicians pick their voters.
Okay, one last issue before we close. Dan, you chair Rev and Tax, one of the most powerful, important committees on Capitol Hill. a lot of talk about the income tax and the tax cut. Give our listeners the latest.
Well, there's just a lot of discussion over, you know, how much of a credit and where we're going to put it. I think you're seeing more, you know, people are minimizing the governor's interest in the Social Security and maximizing the income tax and looking at the child tax credit, I think is where we're
here. And you can't make final decisions till you have final revenue numbers.
I was going to say, that's the problem is we're 2 weeks from numbers.
Okay. So I would love for us to spend more time on this next week and really talk through the different components of that because they're all super interesting and they will take time.
Yeah.
So maybe we can promise that.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I love it. The thing about taxation is that it is the greatest power, in my opinion, that government has to take your money by force.
Yep.
And how you do it really matters.
And the things you tax and the things you don't tax create incentives and disincentives, and you have to mind them all the time.
Yeah. How do you do it efficiently? How do you do it fairly? How do you generate the revenue you need to provide the vital services?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a break here. Senator Dan McKay, Shireen Gourbani, Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.